Okay, welcome everyone. Your attention, please. We have a few practical announcements before we begin today, of which the first, and I'm going to have to see if I can remember all of them, the first and most important is that next week this room has been requisitioned by the university in order to have the rector discussions. So we've been kicked out, which means that there will be no lecture next week. But however, there is an alternative solution, which is that I have made little videos of the material for next week's lecture, and you will be able to watch them online in your own time. And I would strongly encourage you to do so, because next in the videos for next week's lecture is when I discuss the structure of the exam. So if you're interested in passing the exam, which I assume that most of you are, you might want to take a look at those videos when I put them up. They're not up yet, but they will be up in good time before next week's class. So there'll be no lecture next week, and then in 2 weeks' time we'll be back again, and in 2 weeks' time we'll be moving on to the early modern period. Time really does fly. The other practical announcement is that the people who did the experiment last week are back this week, and at the end they are going to do a quick follow-up. So I'm going to finish a little bit early, but it would be very much appreciated if you could hang around for an extra 10 minutes and do the follow-up experiment. Now, was that all I had to announce? No, it wasn't. So I have been ordered to do some publicity for the survey, which I will now do. So please, sag's uns. We have an online survey thing. You can give your opinion, which is very important, about how the university is working, if there are things that can be improved. And you can win some vegetables, as far as I understand it. This must be a German thing. And the reason this is important is because the overall participation has been going down. And this is a bad trend, and we shouldn't allow it to continue, because we need to make sure that the university is listening to us. More importantly, the university listens to me anyway, because I'm a very important person, and I have many leather-bound books. But the university doesn't necessarily listen to you, so you need to be loud and proud about your opinions. Okay, so make sure you take part in the survey. If you've got any questions, these are the people to ask and not me. And that is it on that front. So I think we can actually start with the actual content now. So today we're going to be talking about Middle English. And we're going to start with the question of Anglo-Norman or French influence after a little bit of historical context. That was the one context scenario that we didn't cover last time. We're going to talk about the sources for Middle English and the spelling, just like we did for Old English. We're going to talk about the phonology of the language and the sound changes that happened during this period. And then we're going to talk about what happens to the morphology of the language. And that's as far as we're going to get today. Next week, we're going to come back and talk about, metaphorically come back, because this is videos, talk about the syntax of the language and about the lexicon of the language, and also about what the exam is going to look like. And if you want to find out any more about Middle English in general, beyond what the textbook gives you, I would recommend this book by Horobin and Smith, An Introduction to Middle English, which is a nice little book which should give you everything you need to know. All right, so what's going on during this period, this Middle English period? Remember, we're talking 1150 onwards for the Middle English period. And here what we're seeing is the consequences of the Norman conquest and how that plays out across the whole country. When we look at the development of England linguistically during this time, one of the biggest developments is that England becomes literate. So this becomes the society gradually changes from one in which almost no one could read and write. At the very early stages, only a few monks and a few rune masters. And then at the end of the period, there are a few more monks, but still not much has changed. But during the Middle English period, there are huge changes here. We get from the 2,000 little documents like writs and charters in the Anglo-Saxon England period, the Old English period, from the 13th century alone, we have tens of thousands. So from one single century, much more than from the whole Old English period combined. We also see the development of English as a language that people are proud to speak. Before 1300, certainly after the Norman Conquest, before 1300, English is not seen as a prestige language. If you use English in this period, it needs defending. And some of the writers of this period are quite defensive about their use of the English language as opposed to one of the alternatives, as opposed to Anglo-Norman, for instance, or indeed Latin. But after 1300, we get a re-emergence of English as a language of literature, also as a language of the court, and as a language of the church. So, in a way, after the Norman Conquest, English kind of goes dark as a language and then emerges again after 1300. Now, it's not quite as drastic as all that, and recent research has been showing that actually there's more material and more continuity during this period than was previously thought. If you're interested in this book by Elaine Trehan, which is in the Semesterapparat, is something to take a look at. Here's a brief timeline of what's going on during this period. In 1066, we've got the Norman Conquest. And hopefully, if that still doesn't mean anything to you, you should really look it up in a history book. In 1244, it becomes illegal to hold land in both France and England. And after the Norman Conquest, this is quite a big development because there were plenty of people doing exactly that in that intervening period. In fact, during the early part of this period, it's hard, in a way, to talk about a distinct English and French national identity or any kind of political entity because they are so unified by virtue of the people who are ruling them. In 1258, shortly after that, Henry III becomes the first king of England, post-conquest, to use both English and French as official languages. So English is coming in here as an official language where previously only French would have been acceptable. 1349 sees the first use of English at Oxford University, which previously would have only used Latin and French as its languages. And this is an old institution, right? This university has already been established for several hundred years at this point. So it's really quite striking that suddenly now English becomes a language that is usable in that context. And in 1362, we get the first use of English in the Parliament. We get a political use of English. So English is expanding its domain as a language. And with that, we find that English is finding its voice, and voices, people who write in this language and who feel proud of it, who feel like it can be used as a literary medium as well. So that's what's going on during this Middle English period. This and more. But let's talk a little bit more about these first few hundred years, this Norman and French influence. So Anglo-Norman is a specific variety of medieval French. And it's important to distinguish between features that are specifically Anglo-Norman and features that are French in general. At the very start of the period of influence, the features that are interesting to us come from Anglo-Norman specifically. Later on, the features that come into the language come from French in general. So we've got a bit of both. French itself is an Indo-European language, specifically a Romance language descended from Latin, descended from Vulgar Latin, the Latin of the Roman legions, of the Roman peoples who were colonizing different areas of the empire. In 1066, we get the Battle of Hastings, we get the Norman invasion, and William the Conqueror becomes the ruler of England. And that has huge effects, as we've already briefly discussed. So Norman French, how is it different from standard French of the time? Or not standard French, because there wasn't a standard, but other varieties of French that were around. Well, Norman French retained que before a. So in French, the word for a castle is a château. This is because an initial que has become a ch. This is a change that doesn't happen in Anglo-Norman, in Norman French. So you still get, this word would have been castel in the relevant period, and that is the word that is borrowed into English specifically, castel for castle. this particular kind of fortification. The other thing that Norman French does that makes it very striking is that where standard French has a G, Norman French has a W. So we get words like warranty and reward. They're borrowed into English from Norman French specifically, and you can tell because of this W. Later on, we get borrowings from Norman French that have a borrowings from not Norman French, but from ordinary French, from other varieties of French, with a G, so guarantee and regard with a G. So this is a really, these are two features that set Norman French apart from other varieties of French. Now during this first period, between 1066 and 1250, there are perhaps surprisingly few words borrowed, or at least surprisingly few in the context of what comes next. Fewer than 1,000 words, well that's still a lot of words in the grand scheme of things, and it's certainly a lot more than had been borrowed up until that point from languages like Latin and Celtic. So we get words like, and you can see the context of these words, baron, servant, right? There's a particular political context in which these words are being introduced. Messenger, story is perhaps one of the most common words that is borrowed from Norman French during this period. In the second phase, we get French influence in general that isn't specifically Anglo-Norman, and here we get up to 10,000 words. So here, the influx of French words is truly immense. We get all kinds of words, mostly open class words, so nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs. When I say open class words, what I mean is words that there is, in principle, an unbounded number of. So words like conjunctions and prepositions, there is a fixed, finite number of them, and the number of them doesn't seem to change that much. Same with pronouns, for instance. But open class words are open, and so you can just borrow more and more and more of them. And that is indeed what happened from French. Now, the earlier a loan is, the harder it is to recognize, because it undergoes specifically English sound changes that happen in those later periods. What's worth noting about the Anglo-Norman influence is that it's almost exclusively lexical. So this is an influence. When we think about the other scenarios that we've seen, contact with Scandinavian, with Norse, had some effects that were clearly morphological and syntactic. There are some morphological effects that we'll see in a minute from Anglo-Norman, but the vast, vast majority of the influence that it has is lexical. A couple of other of exceptions to this. One possible exception is that relative clauses introduced by WH words may be influenced by French. So in modern English, we've got a few different ways of forming relative clauses. You can say, the book that I read. You can say, the book which I read. And you can say, the book I read. Now, the book that I read and the book I read are both inherited strategies from Old and Middle English. The book which I read is a new strategy that comes in during the Middle English period. And it could be that this strategy with which, and the man who I met rather than the man that I met. So these WH clauses that are introduced, these relative clauses that are introduced by WH words, they may have spread due to the influence of first Anglo-Norman and later French in general. But that's a rare example of a clear case of syntactic influence from French. What about these lexical borrowings then? Where do they come into the language? Well, there are various different domains. Some domains borrow more prolifically than others. We can say that Anglo-Norman words make their way into English, and French words in general make their way into the English language almost everywhere. But there are a few domains where they're particularly prevalent. So first of all, government, for instance, words that have to do with government. We've already seen baron and servant from the very earliest period, but also the word government itself, to govern, royal, state, the word parliament that we've mentioned, princes, dukes, duchesses, taxes, all of these words come into English via French. Also in the legal domain, the vast majority of our vocabulary comes straight from French, or possibly from Latin via French. So words like judge and jury, evidence, crime itself, all of these words are words that come from French. It's not that they didn't have words for these things before. The Old English had words for crime, sure, but the words for crime that the Old English speakers had got replaced by the ones that were introduced under French influence. Another domain in which these things arise is the domain of learning, of scientific study, of academia in general. So the word study, you also get words for shapes like square, and words for things like geometry, infinity. The word grammar comes from French. Logic comes from French. The word logic. We also see that this French language was associated with high culture. So we see art and fashion words coming in, things like sculpture, color, figure, poet, music. In this domain, French words are extremely common. Another area that's often discussed is the area of food. So many, many food items come from French. And this is probably the most enduring image of the Anglo-Normans. What did they do when they arrived in England? Well, they did a lot of feasting. They had big appetites, so they would feast, they would have dinner and supper, and it would involve bacon and salmon and cream. Probably not all at once, but who knows. So these food words are one particularly common area of borrowing from French, religious words, and also general words, words that it's hard to assign to any specific category, including some relatively basic words like change, destroy. These are not complex words that are associated with one particular thematic domain. They're in very general use. Improvement, for instance. So those are the lexical influences. What about morphology? Well, if you borrow enough words from a language, it stands to reason that you'll also be borrowing the structure of those words. And so through the Anglo-Norman or French influence, we see derivational prefixes and suffixes enter the language. Now, these are not borrowed separately, but they're borrowed as part of words. And a couple of examples are itty, us, and ur. So majority, glorious, and honour. These are all suffixes that come into Middle English through Anglo-Norman and French influence. And we'll talk more about the derivational morphology and influences in derivational morphology in next week's lecture. But mostly, it's important to note, these new suffixes start out being used only with words of French or Latin origin themselves. So these are not, they don't seem to be fully productive. They're not used all over the place with other kinds of root, which suggests that they started out life as simply elements that were part of whole words that were then discerned, if you like, by the users of the English language at that later period. And so at that stage, they became fully productive. And then we find some hybrids. So when I say hybrid in this context, I mean, for instance, an ending that comes from one language and a root that comes from a different language. So in the word endearment, the root is English, dear. That comes from Old English. But the en prefix and the ment suffix both come from French. So we've got French and then an English root and then another piece of French. So this is a kind of an English sandwich with French bread, a roast beef sandwich, perhaps. Disbelief is a similar case. So the root belief is an English belief, is an English word, but dis is a French prefix. And you see words that are the other way around as well. So the word useless, use comes from French, less is a suffix that comes from Old English. It's an inherited Germanic suffix. So these hybrids do exist, but they're relatively uncommon, which suggests that at this very early period, these derivational prefixes and suffixes were not fully productive. And so it's been said that the Anglo-Norman or French morphological influence is not really deep. There may be quite a lot of it, but it's at a relatively superficial level. And derivational morphology is probably the place where we see the most of it. We see almost nothing in the way of effects on the inflectional morphology. In fact, I know of nothing at all. So here's the table we saw last time. And if we want to add to our table, we can say that Anglo-Norman, or probably French more generally, had a huge impact on the vocabulary of the language, more than any of these other languages. It also had morphological influence, like Norse, but unlike Celtic and Latin. But the nature of this morphological influence is different. While Norse morphological influence is felt more broadly and probably more deeply, the Anglo-Norman morphological influence is all over the place, but it's restricted to derivational morphology. We don't see much in the way of syntactic influence from Anglo-Norman or French. Okay, now one big question that often comes up in the discussion of the history of English is whether there is really continuity between the stages of the language. The typical way that the history of the language is taught is exactly as I've taught it today, in this course. So we have Old English that develops into Middle English, that develops into Early Modern English, and that develops into the English that we speak today. But is that the only way of telling this story? Could it be that there is a kind of gap somewhere along the line, that maybe Old English didn't make it, Old English died out, and something else came in to take its place? So maybe there's some kind of discontinuity in the history of English. This has been argued, popularly argued by several scholars. And if you want to learn more about this, you can look at chapter 5 of the textbook, in which section 7 deals with this issue of Creole status. I think, so when we talk about Creole, a Creole language is a language that is developed through language contact specifically, through mixing of languages. And the crucial feature of Creoles from our perspective is that they don't have an obvious place in family trees. They emerge without having a single linguistic parent in the family tree like the languages that we've seen before. And typically, Creoles are thought to exhibit linguistic simplification. If we can even decide what it is that we mean by linguistic simplification, because it's not clear what it means for one language to be simpler than another, or for one aspect of a language to be simpler than another. I think the consensus view among scholars on the history of English is that it is not a Creole, and that Middle English is descended from Old English as a language. And this is because there isn't as much contact influence. While there is a lot of contact influence in the history of English, there isn't as much as we'd expect if Middle English were a full-on Creole. That's probably the dominant view in the literature, but if you want to read a dissenting view, and someone who writes very well, you can read John McWhorter's work. So his first book, one of his books, is called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, which makes the case in the history of English for that contact influence. And his most recent book, The Creole Debate, is a book that deals specifically with the issue of what Creoles are, whether they exhibit simplification, and that kind of thing. These aren't in the Semester Apparat, but they're worth taking a look at nonetheless. And I will try and order some more copies for the library if it turns out that we don't have enough. And I should say, far be it from me to shut down debate on this issue. There are all kinds of interesting questions about the extent of language contact in the history of English. If you want to follow up on some more of these issues, once again, I will plug my She 3 course on language contact in the early history of English, which I teach most summer semesters. You can also take a course on language contact in general from a more present-day perspective from our new multilingualism professor, Theo Marinus. Let's move on now to the discussion of sources and spelling for the Middle English language. Here we've got a picture from Gawain and the Green Knight. And if you're rather confused by what's going on in this picture, then you're right to be, because it looks like this big green guy on a green horse is headless and presenting his own head in his hand to the guy with the halberd. And in fact, that's exactly what's going on. So if you, that's what you think is happening in this picture, you are not misinformed. This is a deeply, deeply interesting text. In fact, there are many, many deeply interesting texts from this period. We've got texts from all kinds of genres. And this on the slide here is just a small selection of the kinds of things that we find from the Middle English period. And this really contrasts quite dramatically with Old English. From Old English, we have a very restricted array of text types. We have a restricted array of text types. We have a restricted array of writers. And all of this really explodes into life during the Middle English period. We get so much more. We get things like travel accounts, recipes, romances, even such exciting things as government documents. All of this is available for your delectation in the early, in the Middle English period. So some of the major works, together with images, the picture you just saw is from Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which is a classic story. You also have texts like the Ormulum, which you can see at the top on your left. You can see Layamon's Brut, which was a text that we're going to come back to a couple of times. That's the long, thin text on the right. We've got Chaucer. So down here we've got a Chaucer manuscript. And Chaucer is going to keep on coming back over the next 2 weeks. Make sure that you bear him in mind, not that it's easy to ignore or forget him. We also have letters. So this is something we don't have from the Old English period at all. People are writing letters to one another, and they've survived. So here we have the Paston letters, which members of the Paston family have been writing to one another. So this gives us a whole different perspective, because previously we've only seen what the high authorities of the language have wanted us to see. In the Old English period, everything we see is written by monks in a monastic context. And it's impossible to overemphasize just how restrictive a picture of the language that was. We don't know anything about what the everyday person in Anglo-Saxon England was doing from these texts. We just don't have that information. We know that there must have been, well, at some stage, millions of people speaking this language and going about their daily lives, fighting and loving and playing and working. And almost all of that goes completely under the radar as far as the texts are concerned, because the only people who are writing things down were these monks. And finally, when we get to the Middle English period, we get a little bit of energy, we get a little bit of variety in the perspectives that are presented to us in this language. And there are various other texts. I mean, we really have loads from this time. We've got early texts, we've got late texts, texts that look more like Old English, texts that look less like Old English. We've got northern texts, we've got southern texts. That too is new. We have very, very little from northern Old English. But towards the later part of the Middle English period, we actually have quite a lot from the north. We have Arthurian texts, texts about the famous King Arthur, hero of... legendary king of Britain, who, by the way, almost certainly didn't exist. I hate to bust the bubble, but he is not mentioned in any contemporary sources. He only comes up much later in the history of the language. So probably he was just someone who was made up. But nice story nonetheless. We get drama texts from this period as well. So the York plays, these are drama texts written in the 15th century in a northern variety. You can go to this website, luminarium.org, and there is a huge array of Middle English texts for you to peruse, should you wish to do so. Okay, so those are the texts. What happens with the spelling? Well, for one thing, there's a lot of variation, and so each text is unique. If you look at these different texts, it's very hard to make big sweeping generalizations about what's going on in this period. What we can say is that there is a tendency for the special characters that we see in the Old English period to disappear. So the early texts from this period retain the ash. They also retain the yog, and here yog has a special function in Middle English. They retain the thorn and the eth. And if you look at this text, the Layamon text, you should be able to see some of the changes some of the characters that are inherited from Old English. So, for instance, the word Layamon itself contains the yog symbol. You should be able to spot a couple of thorns as well in that text. Now, a relatively early development is that that Ash gets replaced by the normal A. So Ash disappears, and Ev also disappears. So Ash and Ev are the first casualties of the Old English spelling system. And the Ev is replaced by the thorn, or simply a TH, as we see in the modern language. And later on, even the thorn dies out, and this gets replaced by the TH. What's interesting about this development is that the thorn, by the time that it's replaced, has changed how it looks. It starts to be written in a different way. So our thorn, if we remember the evolution of thorn, it starts out in the runic alphabet, and it's all made of straight lines, because the straight lines were easiest for rune carvers to make. So a thorn would look like this, right? Very sharp and pointy. The Old English thorn that we see in the manuscript texts, the one that was incorporated into the Insular Minuscule script, looks like this. It's got a sort of a merger of a B and a P, and it's got a stem at the top and a stem at the bottom. Towards the end of the Old English period and into the Middle English period, it starts to become a little bit less symmetrical. So it starts to become longer at the bottom than it is at the top. So that's one development. And at the same time, we start to find this top part getting a little bit weakened. And the final development of thorn that happens just before thorn disappears entirely is that it becomes unlinked at the top. There's a gap at the top. Now this thing, this final form of thorn, looks like a Y. And that's why when you go to England and you see shops that are trying to channel the old Middle English feeling, you will see this word ye, right? As in ye olde shoppy, right? And the ye here, this is a word that never existed in the history of the English language as a definite article, right? It was always the. But the thing is, if you write a thorn followed by an E, it looks like a ye. So that's why you see this ye. It's a fake word. It's fake news. Middle English fake news. It comes into the language essentially because people have misinterpreted it. It's this kind of modern creation. But it does reflect something that was going on. Which would have looked something like this. So this is our ye. Like I've said, each text is unique. If you learn to read one Middle English text, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can read all of the rest. And while that is really annoying, it also means that there's lots and lots of rich material to explore in this period of the language. What else changes in the Middle English period? Well, there's a little overview here. Some of these things we've already talked about, the disappearance of Ev and Thorn. There are some other changes as well. For a start, the letter Q appears in the language at this stage. Old English essentially doesn't use Q. You might see it once or twice, but only in specific loanwords. Middle English uses it all the time. So Old English words, for instance, like queen, queen, this CW gets replaced by QU, queen. So this is where the word queen comes from in the history of English, for instance. QU is quite popular. Also, the spelling HW, as in all of the words that we now call WH words, what, for instance, the first word of Beowulf, the famous first word of Beowulf, This becomes WH, so the letters swap round. This doesn't represent a sound change, it's just the spelling of the word changing. So these are purely spelling changes. It's quite important to emphasize that. Right. In early Middle English, this would have been pronounced queen. In Old English, this would have been pronounced queen. The only difference is how they're spelt at this stage. Later on, queen becomes queen, the vowel changes, and that is due to the great vowel shift. But that is a story for another time. So we see various orthographic changes. Orthographic changes simply meaning spelling changes. Spelling is orthography. We see the SC being replaced by SH. So in words like ship, for instance, if you remember in Old English, ship was written with an SC at the beginning. In the Middle English period, it becomes written with an SH. We see Old English C, which was very ambiguous in this script because it could refer to palatal variants and non-palatal variants, C gets replaced by a more nuanced palette of characters. So C gets replaced by CH, by C, and by K. And while it's not entirely systematic what happens, at least it starts to reflect slightly more what is going on in the spoken language. So this is one of the few spelling changes in the history of English that actually makes any sense, that's actually useful in some regard. We see the U getting replaced by OU, and that is quite probably due to French influence. And we see H getting replaced by the YOG and by GH. Now, some of these changes are probably due to French scribal influence. We get Anglo-Norman and later French scribes coming in to Britain and writing in the native language, and they introduce new scribal norms. So the YOG and the Y are apparently introduced to replace the H character and the palatalized G character, which also wasn't very true to the pronunciation of the language. So in a word like night, in Old English we find nicht with an H. The pronunciation would have been the same in early Middle English, so still nicht, but it was written with a yog. And then it becomes the GH symbol later on when yog itself is lost. But yog survives for longer. Yog, interestingly, in the Old English period, yog is just how the old English writers wrote the letter G. Right. They didn't have a separate G, they just had YOG, and that was how they wrote a G. In the Middle English period, there is YOG and there is G, and they are separate forms, they are separate graphemes. They represent different sounds, or at least they're supposed to. So this is why YOG really only takes on its own life in the Middle English period. And unfortunately, the life of YOG is not very long, because it disappears again after the Middle English period. But we'll get to that. We also find in the Middle English period, double vowels start to be used. So in Old English, bork, this was a long O, and it starts to be written with two O's, just like in the modern language at this time. Similarly, a word like quen, which has a long E, would start to be written as queen with two E's. Again, this doesn't correlate with the pronunciation change of the vowel, that comes later. But what we see is that a long vowel is now being represented by two successive vowels. And that's something that is not at all common in the Old English period. It's a Middle English development. So what happens in the Middle English period with the sounds? Well, vowels start to be distinguished mostly by quality and no longer so much by pure vowel length. In the early period, we still have these pure vowel length distinctions, and we still have vowel length distinctions today, but it starts to be the case that what is making the difference is not actually the length, but it's slight differences in the quality of the vowels. And here you can see the new sounds that emerge are the ones that are in bright green, which may not be hugely visible to you on this screen, but they are there. And if you can't see them, you can look them up on the handout version later on. So vowels start to be distinguished mainly by quality. So whereas previously we would have had a long oo and a short oo, same quality. In the later period, what we see is we get an oo and an oo. Oo, oo. Slightly different quality of those vowels. We also see the loss of the rounded U sound. So this is a sound actually that French has, that German has. U with an umlaut on it is usually in spelling in German. So U. And this becomes a simple unrounded vowel, E. So the rounded vowels are actually lost in the Middle English period. We also find a few new borrowings. So we find the sequence OI, which comes in through French borrowings. We also find that voiced fricatives become phonemically distinct. Now, you might remember that this fricative column, there were no voiced fricatives as phonemes in the Old English period. The voiced fricatives in Old English were determined exclusively by the context. But in Middle English, they become full-on phonemes in their own right. And the usual story that people tell about this is that it's due to French influence as well, because French did have different voiced and voiceless phonemes for its fricatives. Otherwise, the consonant system doesn't change very much. Throughout this period, from Old English into Middle English, the consonant system mostly stays the same. But the vowel system has changed quite a lot. Consonants do get deleted every now and then. The dropping of H is something that is very much thought to be a modern phenomenon in England. So if you see the play Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw, it's about someone who's being taught to speak proper English. And one of the things that she has to unlearn is dropping all of the H's at the beginnings of words. So you have to say, you have to practice saying things like, in Hampshire and Herefordshire, hurricanes hardly ever happen, with a H. The reason that's important is because the particularly low prestige dialects of the southeast drop these H's. But this isn't actually a modern phenomenon. It's something that we see in Middle English texts as well. And here we've got an example. Ich habe, right? This is like ich habe, but without the H. Ich habe, right? So we find dropping of H's in the early, in the Middle English context. So this is something that starts very early. Here again, there might potentially be some French influence. We've got another example from Wycliffe. At an hour, an hour. Right? And this is a word which is pronounced in modern English without the H. It's written with the H, the word hour, but it's never pronounced with the H. No one calls it a hour. Now, this H dropping starts in consonant clusters, and here it's completely systematic. So the word loaf in Old English is a chlaf, and this h is the first thing to go. Similarly, the word rather starts off in Old English as hrather, with a h, and that this initial h in the consonant cluster is dropped. Similarly, the h that you find at the end of syllables is typically either lost or it becomes a f. So in the word dochter, for a daughter, this becomes daughter. And the spelling reflects that there used to be a fricative there, but there isn't a fricative anymore in words like daughter and knight. Again, seach, saw, and knicht with a ch fricative. Yeah, knicht. Excellent. Okay, so this word knicht, related to German knecht, loses its fricative in this context. So these fricatives are getting lost all over the place. We also find W's being lost, and some of them are represented in the spelling later on, and some of them aren't. So for instance, the words so and such were originally soir and swilch, And this were is lost. We also find to, the word to, originally this was toi, and this were again is lost in the context of a consonant followed by a back vowel. Similarly, sword, a sword, becomes sword. It's still written with a W, just like to is still written by it with a W, even though there is no W in the pronunciation. There is no W. And so we can already see how the modern English spelling system is shaping up to be as horrible as it is today. We also find nasals and liquids deleting or assimilating. So there's a few other changes that we can see here. Chwilum for while. Manchester becomes Manchester. So the nasal is assimilating to a position further back in the mouth. Swilch becomes such. The L disappears. So this word swilch is like German solch, which has an L in it, but this L disappears in the later history of English, and so that's how we get such. Similarly, beocht, here the bright, the R, actually does something else here. It metathesizes. It moves to being after, before the vowel, after the initial consonant. So there's a few different changes here that happen to consonants. The biggest one is that fricatives, especially ch, start disappearing. We also find our velar fricative, so this is our ch sound, where it remains, it tends to become a y or a w in the text. Before back vowels or after a liquid, so after a l or a r, it becomes a w. And elsewhere, it becomes a y. So in Old English, we have a word like bora, which is a bow, plora, which is a plough. So here we get this r changing into a w. Similarly, fourol changing into foul. But we get the y. So a word like fahrer becomes fair, fair. Nagel becomes like German nagel becomes Neil, Halrian becomes hallo with a w again, and morgen, morgen with a fricative, as it would have been in Old English, becomes morrow with a w. What about the vowels? Well, it's hard to make generalizations about how the vowels change because they basically go all over the place. So vowels change in length. Sometimes long vowels become short, sometimes short vowels become long. I'm very unlikely to ask you about this on the exam because it's too confusing, but you do need to know that it happens. Before a nasal or a voiced stop, we know that Old English short vowels lengthen. So in words like lamb, comb, mild, and child, the vowels become lengthened. So a word that would have originally been child would have been chilled originally. Before that... voiced stop, it gets lengthened. It would have been something like chilled, and then this E becomes I through the great vowel shift later on. Other clusters cause shortening. So kept becomes kept. So we've got a long vowel becoming a short vowel in that context. We also got vowels that move up and down. So the long A raises to an O in Middle English. So in words like na, mast, ham, and ane, these become no, most, home, and on. And these are the words that give rise later on through the great vowel shift to no, most, home, and one. That's why we've got an O in them. Now, what's interesting about this development is that it's regionally specific. We'll talk more about this next time. So this development happens in the south and in the Midlands, but not in the northern texts. So northern texts retain the A, the long A, in both the spelling and the pronunciation. Short A, on the other hand, undergoes an opposite development, or at least it looks opposite. So this is spelt as or in the north, but not in the south. So this is in words like man, land, hand. In northern texts, we will see what looks like mon, lond, hond with an O. So these A's and O's, if you take nothing else away from this slide, this last blue bullet point is the important one. The long A raising to long O in non-northern Middle English texts. So here's an example of a Middle English text. This is Piers Plowman, poetic text. We can see that we've got alliteration in this text, so the Old English alliterative tradition is being maintained. Later on in the Middle English period, we see rhyming poetry start to emerge. So alliterative poetry is on its last legs at this stage. But this kind of poetry has a really beautiful effect, I think, with the alliteration. So it starts, in a sommer season, when soft was the sonne, I shope men shrudes, as I shape were. So you've got these beautiful fricatives introducing every other word. So this is in a summer season when the sun was soft, I put on clothes as if I were a sheep. I'm not sure if that's there for any other reason than to make it alliterate, but it works pretty well. So this again is a nice story. And we can see some of these Middle English features emerging. So you can see the word shrewd here, shroud, with an OU. This is this French-influenced OU spelling for a long back vowel, for instance. And you can see a yog in the bottom line there, mithochte, which later on would disappear entirely. At least the sound would disappear entirely. But this is already looking quite a lot more modern than some of than the Old English texts that we've seen already. In fact, you could have a good go at understanding this without knowing any Middle English. You might just have to look up some words every now and then to figure out what was going on. Okay, any questions about the sound changes or about anything we've covered so far? Right, so we're going to wrap up today by talking about the morphology, first nominal morphology and then the verbal morphology. And to give the game away, the main thing that happens during the Middle English period is that it all disappears, gradually. So let's look at the pronouns first, because all kinds of interesting stuff happens with Middle English pronouns. This is really where the interesting action is in the Middle English period. So first of all, if you look at this table, this paradigm for the pronouns, you see that there is no more dual. We had these dual forms, wit and yit, for first person when you're talking about two people, and second person when you're talking about two people. Those have disappeared. They're already disappearing during the Old English period, and by the Middle English period, they're completely gone. So no more dual. We also see that there's no more distinction between the accusative and the dative. So from very, very early in the Middle English period, the distinction between the accusative and the dative is gone, is dead. This is a very early development here. We see new pronouns in this system. So the main development that we see here is the they, them, their pronouns in the bottom row. These replace he, him, and here, similar forms that begin with an H in the Old English texts. So these they, them, their pronouns come in new. We also have the word she, the pronoun she, first appearing during the Middle English period. Where does it come from? Well, we're not quite sure. People have ideas about it. But we find this she coming in. In the second person, we find the same pronouns being retained. So we've got thou and thee, though they would have been pronounced thou and they at this stage. And we've got ye and you and your. So the pronoun system is in the second person is retained, but what's interesting here is that it starts to change its meaning. So the form thou starts, thou and they and thine start to not only mean second person singular, but also second person singular familiar. In other words, they start to behave like German du, dich, dir, dein, right? They start to take on this specific context. So the distinction between thu and je in Middle English is a bit like the distinction between du and sie in German. And there are some interesting texts when you look at how Chaucer, for instance, uses these forms. As a modern reader, it can actually tell you a lot about how the characters view each other just by looking at the second person pronouns that they use, whether they're using these more formal, polite, ye forms, or the more informal, and in some contexts, arguably disrespectful, thu forms. So this is something that emerges during the Middle English period and is later lost, but English does go through a stage of having this special second-person pronoun system with a polite, familiar distinction, much like modern German and French. Where do these new pronouns come from? Well, here's a map. We see that both she and the they, their, them forms spread from the north of the country. They, their, them are usually thought to have come originally from Scandinavian. So this is a pronoun borrowing. This is quite a major morphological influence for one language to have on another. Pronouns are not the normal things that languages borrow. Usually languages borrow open class words in the sense that I discussed earlier on, and not closed class words like pronouns. Nevertheless, the normal story is that these words come from Scandinavian, these they, their, them pronouns. And it might also be the case that she comes from Scandinavian, but it might also descend from the Old English demonstrative seo or sio. And it's difficult to tell, especially since the Old English dictionary, the Oxford English Dictionary, lists over 30 variant forms, different spellings, for this word. So you've got she with an E, sho with an O, which is very common, she with an EY, sha with an A. So there are all kinds of different spelling for this form. But what we see during this period is that the form they spreads first, and it spreads down towards the south from the northeast, and the form them follows a little bit behind. So northern speakers during this period would have they and them, southern speakers would have he and hem, and Midland speakers might well have they in the nominative, but hem in the accusative and dative. So this is another feature that you can use to tell Middle English dialects apart. Another thing that happens during this period is that the reflexive pronouns emerge. So himself, herself, themselves, yourself, etc. These pronouns only emerge during the Middle English period. So the pronouns are probably the most interesting thing about the Middle English morphology, because they start to change quite drastically. As for nouns, it's fairly simple. Everything goes in one direction. So the nouns lose their case endings. You will recall the noun paradigms that we saw for Old English. All of that stuff more or less bites the dust during the Middle English period. The genitive s is retained, but very little else is. And if you look at earlier texts like Layamon's Brut, you find dative singular endings in e, but later Middle English texts even lose those. Outside the genitive, in the later Middle English period, if you look at, for instance, Chaucer's writings, the nominal morphology is more or less the same as it is today, as far as nouns are concerned. So the nouns have s in the plural, s in the genitive, and no ending at all anywhere else, just like in the modern language. And the same thing happens to adjectives. So adjectives become modern during this period. The only remnant of this adjective ending is an E. The E sticks around for a little while longer, but it's never quite clear in the Middle English period what the E is doing, why it's there. So sometimes it seems to be purely there for orthographic reasons. Sometimes it seems to have some kind of gender marking function or case marking function, but it's generally fairly unclear during the Middle English period what the E is actually doing on the adjectives. As for the demonstratives, well, the demonstrative paradigm for Old English was the most complicated of all, And in Middle English, as far as the definite article is concerned, it becomes the simplest paradigm of all, because you've just got the. Everywhere you look, you've just got this the form, an invariable definite article. So, in summary, we've got a huge reduction in the forms here. All of the endings are just dropping like flies during this period. The nominal endings on nouns, on adjectives, the differentiation of forms and demonstratives, all of it goes down the toilet during this period of the English language. We're losing all of this morphological intricacy. So this is part of the change away from a synthetic language and towards a more analytic one. And that's something that we're going to come back to next time. Okay, well, if not, we'll move on to the verbal morphology, which is the last part of today's lecture. So the verbal morphology is a little bit more robust than the nominal morphology during the Old English, during the Middle English period. So here we have a paradigm for the verb to find, and what we see is it still looks quite a lot like what we see in Old English, and it still looks quite a lot like what we see in German as well. So the endings do simplify, but we still see quite a lot of different endings that agree in terms of the person and number of the subject. So this system is a little bit more robust than the nominal one, but starting in the north, and this is something we mentioned in the context of language contact, the endings become simplified. The subjunctive is already disappearing and being replaced at this point. So if you look at the singular ending for the subjunctive, it's either just find with no ending, or it's find with an E on the end. Either way, it doesn't give you all that much morphological material to work with. So the subjunctive is starting to die out during the Middle English period. We also find that the ye prefix is weakened. So that the ye prefix, this is like ge in German, this prefix is weakened and starts to disappear during this period. What's characteristic of Middle English, and how you can tell a Middle English text from an Old English text or a Modern English text, is that the prefix becomes the letter Y on its own, sometimes the letter I on its own. So I or I, that is how the prefix, the past participle prefix, is expressed during this Middle English period. In the north, it's often lost. So again, this is a feature that you can use to tell Northern and Southern Middle English texts apart. Now, these endings that I've shown you here are the strong verb endings. There are also weak verb endings, the weak verb endings only differ very slightly. Mainly, they differ in the fact that they have this D in them. So the D that we, as we recall, goes all the way back to the very, very start of the Germanic languages. This is the dental preterite that is so characteristic of all of the Germanic languages. So the verb agreement pattern is starting to lose its complexity, but it's not quite as far along the same road as the nouns, at least not just yet. The other thing that's interesting during this period is that some verbs can be either strong or weak. So if we take the verb to walk, this is used by Chaucer both as a strong verb and as a weak verb. So we've got the strong form, I welk alone, meaning I walked alone. And then we've got the weak form in the following, in the fields walked we, or in the fields walked we. So this Chaucer, this verb is sort of wobbling around between strong status and weak status. And some verbs that are weak in the present day language were still strong in the Middle English period. So the verb laugh and help, for instance, nowadays the past of laugh is laughed with a D. In Middle English it was laugh with a vowel alternation. So laugh, laugh. And help, the past is now helped. And in the Middle English period it would be holp or holpen. And that is retained even actually until the early Modern English period. But on the whole, the trajectory is from strong to weak. And we see a lot of strong verbs and weak verbs getting confused during this period. So Old English has a strong verb, duvan, to dive, and a weak verb, duvan, to dip. The distinction is only in the contrast in the vowel, but diving and dipping are two different things, right? You don't dive your chips into tomato sauce. So, but the strong form here becomes obsolete by 1300. The verb changes to weak. These two forms essentially get merged together and completely confused. And the modern form dove, as in he dove into the water, is actually a more recent innovation. So this is one of the rare examples of a verb innovating a new strong form, because on the whole, there is a massive tendency for strong verbs to become weak during this period, and nearly a third of the Middle English, of the Old English strong verbs, become weak during this period, or we can call them, we can say that this is being lost. But strong verbs become lost or become weak early on in this Middle English period. So here's a text. This is Malory's Mort d'Arthur, a text about the death of King Arthur. And this is a West Midlands text, a very late Middle English text. And you can see some of these Middle English features in this text that we've discussed. So, for instance, hopefully this should be quite easily readable for the most part. In May, when every lusty heart flourisheth, we've got this eth ending in the third person singular. This is retained. And burgeoneth, this is another word meaning to flourish, to burgeon. We still have this in the modern language, but it's got an eth ending here, third person singular. The Middle English eth ending is still intact, especially in the south. Then we've got as the season. Note that this is the season and not se season or that season or any of those complicated demonstrative forms that we saw in the Old English period. Lusty to behold. Behold has an e on the end of it. So this e is the infinitive ending, which is still retained during this period. And then we've got a plural ending in the next line. So man and woman, plural, rejoicen, so plural n. And gladden, with plural n, of summer coming with his fresh flowers. And fresh has an e on the end. What that e on the end is doing is not clear, because this is an adjective. It's anybody's guess what this means. Flowers, plural s. And this plural s is spreading during the Middle English period and becoming dominant. Similarly, in the end of the line, winter with his rough winds and blasts, with an S plural ending. So there are some of the morphological features that are so characteristic of Middle English texts. Hopefully what you can also see is that the later Middle English texts, the late 15th century texts, are not that difficult. They're not all that much more difficult than reading Shakespeare, for instance. And that's not surprising, because we're actually dealing with maybe 150 years prior to Shakespeare. So the language is already quite familiar by this point. All right, then, to wrap up, all kinds of things are changing during the Middle English period. In terms of the spelling, the alphabet starts to take on its modern form during this period. There are various sound changes that also occur. So we get glides emerging, consonants get deleted, and vowels start to change in length. Nouns and adjectives lose their endings. The pronoun system is doing all kinds of fascinating things. And the verbal endings are starting to simplify, though they're not fully down the road to simplification just yet. There's still a good way for them to go, which we'll end up discussing in the early modern lecture in 2 weeks' time. Next week, just a reminder, next week there is no lecture here, but you will be expected to listen to the lecture videos to watch them in advance. So make sure that you do that, and make sure that you are also well prepared for this week's tutorials. For this week's tutorials, what I want you to do is spot predominantly morphological differences. I want you to focus on the morphology this time round. In case you're interested, there's an audio version of this file, of this text 4, that you can listen to online if you want to have an idea of how it was pronounced. So next time round is Middle English 2, and the video is going to be placed online soon for you to watch those videos. I will see you in 2 weeks' time, but don't go anywhere just yet, because if you were here last week, we would like you to stick around and do a little very quick follow-up to the experiment that went on last time. And so I will now hand you over to the experimental organizers.